Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. Today on the podcast, we're discussing leadership. This is an episode from our podcast series called No Bullshit Leadership, which is now in its fourth season. Our host is the speaker and author, Chris Hurst, who's joined by former artistic director of the National Theatre, Sir Nicholas Heitner, and they discuss the unique challenges of leadership in a creative profession and what's needed to revitalize the art sector in the UK and the lessons he's learned throughout his career so far. Here's Chris with more.
Hello, I'm Chris Hurst, and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast brought to you by Intelligence Squared. Leadership is difficult, but not complicated. I want to help you cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, sport, politics, or as in today's case, the arts. I'm delighted to be joined this episode by the director, Sir Nicholas Heitner. He's currently the artistic director and founder of the Bridge Theatre, the first privately funded theatre to open in London for over 80 years. Previously, he was the artistic director of the National Theatre for 12 years, from 2003 to 2015. And he has multiple major successes as a director on screen and stage, including Miss Saigon, The History Boys, One Man, Two Governors, and the BAFTA award-winning Madness of King George. It's quite a CV. Welcome to the podcast, Nicholas.
It's great. Very good to be here. Thank you.
Let's start briefly, at least, at the beginning. So tell me where you grew up, and was theatre always in your blood?
Yeah, I grew up in Manchester, and it was. I was taken to the theatre as a kid. I was enthusiastic from a very young age. There was a lot of theatre at my school. I was at Manchester Grammar School, and I did theatre as an undergraduate. So it was very, very easy to discover it. I think that it's quite a contrasting background to many equivalent backgrounds today, where theatre is quite hard to find because arts and humanities have been stripped out of the state school sector. And the worry, therefore, is that it's much, much more difficult to light upon an enthusiasm if the riches that are available are never made available to you at an early age.
Did you have, if you like, theatrical heroes as you were growing up, whether famous or not? I mean, was there a particular teacher or somebody who you look at and go, you know what, it was them, or a group of people that really introduced you?
There's always a teacher. There was an English teacher who ran the drama. Drama was not an academic subject when back in the 60s and 70s. It was something that you did extracurricular. There was an English teacher called Brian Fithian, who was entirely inspirational and who took school trips to local theatres in Manchester, theatres outside Manchester, and also to Stratford. So my early professional theatrical heroes were essentially the actors and directors at the Royal Shakespeare Company in the 70s. Peter Brook, which, you know, any theatre director of my generation will almost inevitably cite Peter Brook, and a specific production, Peter Brook's Midsummer Night's Dream, mid-70s Midsummer Night's Dream, as the epiphany.
And can you identify a point when you saw it as something that you could do for a living, let's say, as opposed to something you did for fun?
On the one hand, I came from middle-class Jewish family, aspirational, theatre was not something that was necessarily an advisable way to earn a living. On the other hand, I did have a cousin, a second cousin, who was an actor and an aunt who was a costume designer. There were at least people who showed that it wasn't completely lunatic to try to earn a living in the theatre. Of course, I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid. I learned early enough that I wasn't an actor, never to have a proper go at that professionally. I've very rarely been paid for acting, occasionally, but very rarely.
So cut to today, you're a hugely successful producer, director, artistic director, entrepreneur, all of which we'll hopefully come and look at in a bit more detail. But a podcast about leadership, and it strikes me that they all require leadership skills. But also, I wonder if quite different types of leadership skills, and you've thrived at all. I mean, my background, by contrast to yours, mine has essentially only been a business background, if you like. How would you describe the kind of leadership skills that you have to have in a rehearsal room, in taking a group of, I guess, often strangers, pulling these people together and turning by some alchemy that into this extraordinary performance?
Maybe this isn't too helpful, but it differs play by play, movie by movie. I'm much more practiced in a rehearsal room. And there are many different kinds of theatre directors. There are theatre directors who have a clear vision and they pull others along through the brilliance of the vision and the force of the personality behind them until they can fulfill the goal that they had in mind right at the start. There are playwrights like that. There are playwrights who know exactly what the ideal production of their play is going to look like. And therefore, and often they are 100% right. But therefore, the finished product can only ever be a disappointment. There are directors who...
You mean disappointment to them?
Yeah.
But
that's... I've worked with one such playwright.
So they must be tortured souls. Is that why
they're always miserable. They're the exception. So most playwrights, I'm coming at this actually through initially from a playwright's point of view, most playwrights will be delighted by what actors bring to the thing that was flat on the page. I think directors have to be similarly surprised. It's certainly the way I find it works best. The process starts with the selection of the play. If it's a new play, it very often involves collaboration with the playwright, the editing of the play, a job equivalent to a literary editor, to an editor at a publisher. It will then move on to the visualization of the play with a designer. All the time, it seems to me that the most effective method is to encourage the collaborator to surprise you if you're the director, to acknowledge that if you're the director, you likely can't make a model, you can't draw, you act poorly, you can't compose music, and yet somehow you do also have to acknowledge that you are the creative center. You present often on the first day of rehearsal something which has, in certain aspects, been finished. This is what it's going to look like. The choice has been taken, say you're doing Julius Caesar, the choice has been taken not to invent an ancient world, but to try and create a synthesis of the ancient world, the world Shakespeare was writing for, and our own world that we're performing to. These decisions have very often been taken. And then what you have to do if you're the director of the play is to allow yourself to be surprised yet again, constantly to be surprised. Sometimes the job involves straightforward teaching. Again, if I take just randomly taking a Shakespeare as an example rather than a new play, there will be younger members of the company who do require a lot of just straightforward teaching, showing how to do it. Sometimes there's a right and a wrong. And I think that leadership sometimes does involve finding the best way to say, you're wrong about that. But acting, particularly numbers of actors acting with each other, it's not about discovering the right and the wrong. It's about discovering the common ground and agreeing collectively about, as it were, the metaphorical space that a story, an event is going to occupy. And as a director at the center of that.
I mean, it seems to me that listening to you, being a good communicator must be an absolutely critical skill.
Yes, being a good communicator. I think intuiting the emotional temperature, without being pretentious, it should be an emotionally raw process acting, particularly in the rehearsal room. A great performance is very often not simply pulling on somebody else's clothes, simply chameleon-like transforming into somebody else. It's always going to be a process of self-discovery. So there are always going to be emotional hurdles to jump. There's also very often technical hurdles to jump. Actors who want to achieve something, who want, say, and I'm oversimplifying, to cry, but can't. They either don't have the technical equipment or they aren't emotionally ready yet. It's no good pushing an actor into a place where an actor is simply going to feel that they failed. So being sensitive to what an individual actor, to what a designer, to what a lighting designer, to what anybody is capable of doing today. And I'm sure I know this is a read across into other kinds of business leadership. Yeah, that's very much part of the process. And what if Brutus is on song, but Cassius is having trouble? It's waiting for the moment when they can meet on the same ground. I often, when I'm talking to younger directors, talk about a movie I made of Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, in which Daniel Day-Lewis and the great English actor Paul Scofield had several scenes together. And they could not have been more different, because Daniel Day-Lewis is, again, to oversimplify, a method actor. He has to become the character that he's playing. What that means is that prior to the day you shoot a scene on the set, he is disturbed by rehearsal, because rehearsal is a kind of incontrovertible proof that the job is artificial. Once you start repeating somebody else's lines over and over and over, you are face to face with the essential aspect of the job, which is that you're saying somebody else's words in a way that has to be considered and honed, and you have to stand on the right spot, because otherwise the shot will be out of focus. And you have to make sure you don't overlap with the other actor, or you won't be able to cut it together. Scofield, who Daniel Day-Lewis came onto the film worshipping, because Scofield appeared to have an extraordinary mystery to the way he acted initially entirely technically. He looked for the sound of the line. He rehearsed the vowel sounds. They couldn't have come from more different places, and they were rather bewildered by each other. The point was that, preparing in different ways, they arrived at exactly the same place on the day the cameras rolled. So again, you know, you're always dealing with people who do a job which it's very difficult to describe acting in different ways, and you just need to know or discover where they're arriving on the night.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
I mean, that is fascinating listening to you. So let's talk about the National Theatre. It's not just a very big, high profile job, first of all, that, you know, I guess there's a lot of interest in the new artistic director. What's he going to bring? How's he going to handle it? But also, you're taking on a national institution as well. I mean, did it feel like a very different type of job to the job you'd done before? And if so, in what way? What were the new things that came with it?
Well, the new things that were most exciting to me were the entire creative profile of the National Theatre, the repertoire, the plays it was going to do, the way they were going to be done, the people who were going to do them, the what they added up to over the course of a long period, that I'd never done. I'd only been responsible for one thing at a time, a play or a movie. So, and that, I think, there's a reason why most theatres have an artistic director and an executive director or a chief executive or whatever. And although by name I was chief executive, essentially the organization was run by my colleague, Nick Starr, with whom I've continued to work on the current project, the Bridge Theatre. And I always preferred essential decisions, even repertoire decisions, to be bought into not just by executive director Nick Starr, but also by the group of associate directors I gathered around me. And it would be relatively rare that I would unilaterally make a decision on, say, repertoire without making sure that I wasn't crazy. I guess this also is a read across to any kind of business leadership. So the essential part of the job was, what are the plays going to be? Who's going to come see them? Who's going to be in them? And how are they going to get done? And since my previous experience had been about putting on individual plays, it's a pretty good grounding to come to artistic direction from. It's not 100% essential, but that's it's.
So it felt different but familiar, or familiar enough. Yeah, yes,
and I knew the National Theatre. I'd been working there on and off for a while. So, and I had a really clear idea in 2001, which is when I was appointed. I took over in 2003, of how it could be and why it might be different from what was going on. Which is
that was going to be my next question. So that's a nice segue. So what was that? What was your vision for it, if you like?
Well, the formula I used was that the two component parts of the name, National and Theatre, need constant re-examination. And it's why the leadership of an institution like that needs to change every decade or so. Because it felt that I had colleagues who I had grown up in the theatre with, who were doing exciting things with the idea of theatre that hadn't necessarily been seen or hadn't necessarily been established as part of the grand mainstream that the National Theatre represents. There was also an evolving country, an evolving city, an evolving idea of who we were. So, and that is something which changes generation by generation. There was also an absolute conviction, an instinct, which we later kind of provided evidence to support, that there was an audience available that was being locked out by ticket prices. And that was kind of one of the biggest deals I felt when I started. The National wasn't full because as a result of a long period of funding shortfalls, ticket prices had risen beyond a place where a lot of the existing audience and a huge number of the potential audience couldn't come. So we dealt with that. We formed a partnership with the foreign exchange company Travelex. Travelex enabled us to have a big £10 ticket program. They didn't fund it in its entirety, but they enabled us to take the risk with the proposition that if there were a lot more tickets, a lot cheaper, a lot more people would come. And in the end, the ticket revenue wouldn't be that different from higher ticket prices and lower capacity. We arrived, Nick Starr and I, at a very fortunate point, 2003, the second Labour government, the purse strings were being open, funding rose, there was a period between 2003 and 2010 when funding was adequate for all the things, not just in London, but also in the regions. There was a vast increase in funding of regional theatre. It meant that audiences grew, the work became more adventurous, and everything looked pretty good. it has gone so sadly in a different direction.
Well, I was going to talk to you. I was going to ask you about that later on, but I mean, let's talk about that now. I mean, I was going to ask you about the debate about the ENO, the English National Opera. I mean, for those that don't know, the government has said they're going to essentially cut the funding of the English National Opera unless it moves out of London.
Yes, that is right. So look, I now work in the commercial theatre. Mm. So recent funding decisions don't affect me or my theatre directly. There has always been a symbiotic relationship between the commercial theatre and the publicly funded theatre. The two are totally reliant on each other. Both sectors are reliant on an education system. I alluded to this earlier, that allows secondary school students in particular to know what's going on and what they might get interested in, and in some parts of the sector, it equips them for the kind of understanding that you need, basic understanding of some of the more difficult forms of performing arts, which are also almost by definition some of the most rewarding forms of performing arts. Where we're at now is, I think, partly through negligence, partly through ignorance, and partly through ideology. The education has been in the secondary, in the state sector, essentially destroyed. So inevitably now, performing arts institutions themselves are looked to provide what the education system isn't providing. That's a vast extra burden, a vast extra expense, which all performing arts institutions gladly take on because we believe in it. There's less money available to make the art, even before you start, because you're doing all this other stuff as well. Now, funding itself is being reduced, not just a little bit, but quite dramatically. It's a real shame because during the pandemic, the government stepped up. The current government hasn't been 100% neglectful of the art sector, but it's now being aggressively neglectful. In the name of leveling up, what has happened is that funding has been reduced in London to an extent that it will harm or in some cases destroy successful institutions, successful producers, to deliver minimal, truly minimal uplifts in the rest of the country. It's leveling down. It is unambiguously leveling down. We're dealing with less than 0.1% of the total public spending pot, a good deal less than 0.1, a good deal less than 1,000th part of government spending goes to the arts. It's demonstrable that investment in the arts is effective not just in delivering excellent art, but at school level, effective in raising educational standards. The Borough of Newham in South London, which has recently had to cut its music policy, providing for all primary school students the opportunity to learn an instrument, no longer, that program has been ended through lack of funding, had hard data which showed that involvement in the performance of music resulted in a higher, better results in other areas of education than just music. I mean, I could go on forever. What it boils down to is, when I was at the National Theatre, we had enough money. Now there isn't enough money. Less money means less product. Less product means less work flowing into the commercial sector, means less revenue out at the other end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, periodically people have asked me about, because as somebody who worked in the creative industries, in different parts of the creative industries, but somebody who spent their career in advertising, you know, I've always felt that I passionately agree with you, you know, that unless kids, for want of a better word, are coming in to the creative industries in the broadest sense, a purely economic point of view, the debate goes beyond that. But even if you just look at it from a purely economic point of view, I think it's going to be detrimental to something that the country's good at. So I'm going to take us back to a slightly more positive place. So you have 12, I think, hugely successful years in the National Theatre, and then you take what seems to me another very scary, it seems to me scary, you might tell me otherwise, step, and you set about opening the bridge, as I said in the introduction. Can you just talk to me about the sort of the vision and the ambition that you had and have, I guess, for the bridge?
Well, the vision has been modified by COVID.
The vision
was pretty straightforward. The proposition was, it's possible to make commercial theatre outside of London's West End. It is therefore possible to work with developers outside of the West End, but in central London, in Zone 1, for whom a large performing arts space might be very beneficial, both in terms of planning, in terms of making a project attractive to in planning terms, but also in commercial terms. And that was a proposition that was kind of harsh. It was based on a degree of dissatisfaction with the experience of producers of plays in the commercial West End, where all creative risks are taken by producers who deliver creative projects, finished shows, musicals, plays, whatever, to landlords who certainly prior to COVID were operating in a seller's market. And you, if you're a producer of a play, you're in a position where you're taking basically all the risks, doing all the work, and providing most of your upside, delivering most of your upside to the landlord from whom you're renting a theatre. Nick Starr and I thought that it might be a good idea to actually go back to the future, to go back to what was going on at the end of the 19th century, where theatres were built by producers who were putting stuff on the stage to house their own stuff. The Savoy Theatre in the West End was built by Doyley Cart to stage the Savoy operas by Gilbert and Sullivan. It's still called the Savoy Theatre. So we found a development near Tower Bridge, actually next door to Tower Bridge, overlooking overlooking the Tower of London on the south bank of the Thames.
So, as well as you sort of describing the commercial underpinning of it, or the commercial rationale, let me say, of it, did you also have a sort of, of course you had a creative vision, but did you have a way of, it has a distinct, if you like, commercial story. Let me say that. Did you have a clear vision for what it's, for it having a distinct creative story? Was there a bridge type of play, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that also has changed. Mm. Because the creative story was, you know, listen, I've done the National Theatre. I can't pretend that I'm in touch as I once was with the stuff that's bubbling up from the grassroots anymore. I thought, and I still think, that I'd found a way of connecting a particular kind of play, a particular kind of show, musical, to a large audience in a way that satisfied me creatively, in a way that didn't compromise simply in order to achieve widespread popularity. I thought there was a way of commissioning playwrights and rethinking great work from the past for a large audience, large enough for it not to need any degree of philanthropy or public patronage. So it was, yeah, the premise was that I've done enough along with the team that I work with across the entire spectrum, from experimental minority interest, the kind of stuff you absolutely need to do to find the stuff that's popular tomorrow. I've done enough at that end, and I've also done enough at the super popular end to be able to create a niche for high quality work, popular enough to be commercially attractive to a group of investors who were, to be fair, interested, enthusiastic enough to take a punt on something that didn't look like it was a complete commercial slam dunk. I think it's not just COVID. everything else that's happened over the last 3 or 4 years means that in the theater now, the stuff that worked 10 years ago, the stuff that I really feel confident about having to do, knowing how to do, isn't necessarily the thing that's currently required. And it's also a change in the temper of the times. So although there is still an audience and an enthusiastic, committed, delighted audience for the reinvention of the kind of great play that used to just fly at the National Theatre, there's a committed audience for very good work. There isn't a mad rush at the box office for quite the same spectrum of work that there used to be. You can still have a smash hit. There's always room for a smash hit, and you can still put a big star in a play. Ralph Fiennes, we had earlier in the year, sold out. Ralph Fiennes is a huge movie star and also a great actor. No problem. But the work which at the National I used to be completely 100% confident about, very good work, it's now much more precarious. So while we're waiting, and I think we are waiting for the next new thing, what's going to replace that? What's going to be the...
You mean the next new thing in terms of literally a play, or do you mean in terms of a style, a genre, a movement?
It's not going to be one thing.
No.
The zeitgeist will reform, and the audience will coalesce around that, and things will look rosy again. But you know, we've been here before. I started in the theatre during the 80s when things were pretty ropey. Again, because of a much more competent government in the 80s, much more competent.
It's not a high bar.
I know, but it was ideologically, it was simply opposed to the idea of public subsidy. So public subsidy shrank. Now we have this kind of lethal combination of incompetence, neglect, malice, and Brexit. Plus, Brexit has been a disaster for the performing arts sector, a total disaster for the performing arts sector because of talent. Yeah. Because of talent and freedom of movement was at the center of both ways. People going and working in other great cultural capitals, and people from other great cultural capitals coming to work here.
I remember sitting on a panel either immediately before or immediately after the vote, and what struck me about the talent discussion, the freedom of movement around talent, was that I always thought, you might correct me, but I always thought, you know, if the London Symphony Orchestra needs a new conductor, you know, that person is going to get a visa wherever they're from in the world to come and conduct the people who have already made it, let's say, are going to get the visas. But often, when you're talking about real creativity and creative reinvention, the energy that creativity brings, often that happens in the gap, as I see it, between somebody sleeping on somebody's sofa and them becoming that person who's made it. It's that thing they suddenly do, they suddenly arise from, and it's those people that we're blocking from coming in. They're doing that leap somewhere else.
Totally, and we're also robbing them, a lot of them, of a living. The music industry... Until this is why I say malice. Theresa May's deal actually carved out something for musicians, carved out kind of mutual recognition for performing artists to be able to perform as they used to in the rest of Europe. Young bands whose living depends on being able to tour, not just in this country, but everywhere else too. Young opera singers whose living depends on being able to fly over for a week and fill a gap or just take a job in Madrid. All that. So we're now in this ludicrous position where we are producing the talent, training the talent, and making it almost impossible for them to earn a living. It's like banging your head against a brick wall. Lots of people say it, but until some kind of pragmatic willingness to find solutions to these pretty easy problems to solve, if only pragmatism would take hold again, we're pretty screwed.
Well, I always think we
we've talked about leadership as a podcast about leadership. I always think that the dogma exists in black and white, whereas I think leaders need to lead in color. You have to always. I mean, you were talking earlier about the way directors find a path to bring great talent together, and you know, incredibly diverse in all meanings of the word. Talent together to create some amazing alchemy that happens, that sort of flares, and then they all go their own way again. There's something in that. But to be able to do that, as you say, everybody's different. You have to go in with, yes, clarity of objectives and all the things you're trying to achieve, but you can't go in with a dogmatic approach to how you're going to do it. And I think leadership is about seeing things in lots of different colors. And we need a bit of that. I couldn't agree more. So I've got two last questions for you. The first is, you know, we've talked, you know, you've had this absolutely incredible career, and I'm sure much, much more still to come. When you look back from now at thus far, what are you most proud of? What's either the moment or the achievement that you're most proud of?
Well, I think honestly, making the decision not just to focus on my own stuff, one thing, one gig after the next, just getting myself together to believe that I could do something at the National Theatre with the National Theatre. It means that I can look back on numberless plays that I wouldn't have directed, wouldn't necessarily have happened unless I'd given them the nod, on careers that I got involved in at an early stage, not just at an early stage, on creative ambitions that I was able to help enable for other people. This you don't get if you're just directing one movie after the next, one play after the next. So I think the thing I'm proudest of is all the careers I managed. I can't big it up too much. It's through the position I held, but all the careers I was able to get involved in.
Well, you know, I love that answer because I often think, well, how, you know, because leadership's this thing, everybody talks about it, but it's also can run through your fingers. It's like sand. It's very hard to grab hold of and say, well, what did I actually do? Or what actually does a great leader do? And I always think a great question is to ask, for any leader to ask themselves is, you know, am I good for the careers of the people that work for me? And if the answer to that, and everybody has different sorts of careers, but if you can have just about answer, yes, I think I am, then you're doing an awful lot of things right, I think.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, if I think of just two careers, two great artists at random, Marianne Elliott, great director, her biggest success at the National when I was there was War Horse. James Graham, great writer. Those are major artists who would have had great careers anyway. I'm not going to pretend that I made their careers. But when James Graham, I went and saw a play that James Graham had written at the Bush Theatre in Shepherd's Bush, asked him to come meet me at the National, and he pitched to me a play about the end of the Labour government in 1979, set in the Whip's office. And looking back on that, I said, you weren't even born then. What on earth? What on earth? And he pitched it so brilliantly that I think anybody in my position would have said, yeah, okay, go ahead, we'll commission that. And that became a play called This House, which then took us all by surprise. It was a huge popular hit. It started off in the smallest theatre, transferred to the biggest theatre, toured all over the country. I'm not saying that was down to me.
It's all down to you, no.
I'm just saying, God, it was great to be the guy who said yes.
Well, look, Sir Nicholas Heitner, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on, and thanks for your time.
I've really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. The episode was produced and edited by Isabella Soames.